And how about the pronunciation in this episode? Like the characters couldn't figure out whether it's Felicium or Felicium or Narins or Narins.
This episode of MetaTrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Episode 9 of MetaTrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me tonight is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing the first season TNG episode, Symbiosis, specifically focusing on the issues surrounding the Prime Directive in that episode. So, Mike, how are you tonight, first of all? But second of all, this episode was your suggestion. You wanted to talk about TNG as TNG's episode, Symbiosis, and focus on the Prime Directive. How are you tonight?
I'm doing very well. I'm looking forward to this discussion. You know, the Prime Directive probably isn't the most broad subject for us to dig into. But the thing that caught me about this particular episode is this is actually an instance in which we brought up the Prime Directive in the Star Trek universe, and we didn't throw the darn thing out the window, out the airlock. So we actually applied the Prime Directive here, and there was some discussion about the philosophy of the Prime Directive. So I thought it would be a good, you know, lighthearted conversation in light of this particular episode, Symbiosis. I'm sure we'll get into some other episodes as well where the Prime Directive was either applied, misapplied, or, again, thrown out the airlock. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun episode.
That's a really excellent point. Most of the time, our beloved characters are faced with a dilemma of how to go about violating the Prime Directive. But in this episode, they actually toe the line and stick to the letter of the law on the Prime Directive. So that's a fascinating contrast with most of the episodes that deal with the Prime Directive.
But Zachary, before we dive into the conversation, we want to remind our listeners about the contest that we've got going on. If you go onto iTunes and leave us a star rating and a review, we're going to put your name in a hat, and at the end of the contest, which ends January 15th, we'll draw a lucky winner out of the hat, and we're going to send you a Trek FM hoodie from the Trek FM store. And we want to remind everybody about the Trek FM store, Trek FM. Go to our website, trek.fm/store. That'll take you to our Redbubble store, where you'll find just an incredible selection of Trek FM merchandise. All the merch you can find for Trek FM is there on a Redbubble store. Shirts, hoodies, pillows, cups, mugs, you name it, it's in there. All of the art was created by our fantastic art director, Aaron Harvey. The particular hoodie that we're going to be shipping out to one lucky reviewer is going to be the word bubble. I love this particular design, and this is the design I ordered for myself, a shirt. It is the Trek FM has all of the names of the Trek FM shows, some of the taglines from some of those shows, some of the more popular things that they say, and that was all put into a word bubble that looks like the Enterprise. Aaron did an incredible job with all of the art, but that one in particular caught my eye, and Zachary, you and I thought that would be an excellent design to get out to one lucky reviewer. Just go into iTunes, leave us a star rating between now and January 15th, along with a review, and we will be more than happy to put your name in that hat, and one of you lucky listeners will receive a Trek FM hoodie from our Redbubble store at trek.fm/store.
And we should say also that we're going to grandfather in people who've already left us a review on iTunes. There are, I believe, 3 reviews of MetaTrek so far on iTunes. Thank you, everyone who's taken the time to leave that review for us. It really helps other Apple users find our show, Metatrex. So we just want to thank you for taking the time to leave those comments and reviews and star ratings. And anyone who's left us a comment already will be grandfathered into the contest. So if you've already left us a review, don't worry, you're in the contest as well.
All right, Zachary, shall we dive into our conversation? And we should say this will not be the last conversation I'm sure we have about the Prime Directive. I'm sure we'll have many more. But again, we wanted to frame this one in the context of symbiosis, one example in which the Prime Directive was applied and used.
You were mentioning before the show, Mike, that the Prime Directive actually has, did you say 47 individual sub-clauses or sub-points?
47 parts to the Prime Directive.
It sounds like if there's 47, we need Larry Nemechek to come on the show to talk about the Prime Directive with us again in a future episode.
Yes, Larry, please join us in the future to talk about the Prime Directive. We offer you an open invitation to join us on Metatrex. We want to discuss all 47 parts.
All 47, exactly.
All 47 of them. And hey, we'll let you plug your Portal 47. That was free commercial.
Well, Mike, to start us off in the discussion, do you want to first give us a summary of Symbiosis, that first season TNG episode?
Yeah, sure. This episode actually starts out as a typical TNG episode. They are surveying a star. They're collecting data. There's some interesting conversation going back and forth about the tension level as they take the Enterprise closer to the star. And then all of a sudden, our typical Enterprise episode, our typical TNG episode gets interrupted by a distress call from a couple of high Anarians who have run into some trouble with their ship and can't seem to fix the problem, can't diagnose the problem, not even sure they care that there is a problem, but they do need help. They do know that. So as the Enterprise often does, it decides to go to the aid of the Anarans, and so they end up having to beam survivors. They didn't get all of them. They beam survivors to the ship. And then they find out that they were shipping, carrying cargo. At this point, we don't know what the cargo is. We later find out it is Felicium. So the Anarans begin to experience withdrawals from something that they described as medicine. We later find out it's actually a narcotic. Dr. Crusher reveals that to us about mid-episode, that this is actually a narcotic, and that narcotic is being supplied by a sister planet whose sole industry is the refining and manufacturing of Felicium for the Anarans. And now we have an interesting dilemma. What is the Enterprise's, and particularly Captain Picard's, what is their duty to the Anarans? What is their obligation to see this through, or do they wipe their hands clean and walk away? And that's where we find ourselves in Symbiosis.
I should say that this is one of my favorite first season TNG episodes. It has a little bit of everything you'd expect from Star Trek The Next Generation. It's got a Prime Directive dilemma. It's got commentary on 1980s style drug addiction with the narcotics. It's got a speech from Captain Picard over some very inspiring music. It's got any number of different things, different aspects to it. So it's one of my favorite episodes from the first season. It's really well-written dilemma. And I think what I love about the dilemma in this episode is that there's no happy solution to it, right? On the one hand, if Picard gives the warp coils to the Ornarans, he's going to propagate the continuation of this drug addiction, which is obviously harmful to them as a society. On the other hand, if he fails to give them the warp coils, in other words, if he throws a wrench in the works of this narcotic trafficking that's essentially going on between these two worlds, then he's going to cause a great deal of economic harm to the Brekkens. And so no matter which way you cut it, there's harm to someone. And I think a lot of Prime Directive stories can be a little more cut and dry than this, where there's a clear sort of right and wrong. There's clear better consequences. And despite the fact that there's a very inspiring speech from Picard about the virtues of non-interference, the actual dilemma strikes me as a sort of a rock and a hard place dilemma, where either way you cut it, there's not going to be a great ending for someone. For one of these two worlds is going to have a less happy ending as a result of whichever choice Picard makes.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about this episode, and it's one of the more campy episodes, I think, here in the first season. But honestly, that's what I kind of like about it. I'm starting my fifth. This will be my fifth comprehensive rewatch. I've gotten into. And when I ran,
I can't believe you're keeping track of how many rewatches you've done. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm
you're
actually
so much more organized than
my
I
fifth time through TNG. So yeah, a lot of time watching Star Trek. But as I came back across this episode, I was just reminded of just how much I do enjoy this episode. And yeah, to some degree, it's for the campiness of it. You mentioned, you know, the commentary about drug addiction in the middle of the episode. It was kind of funny because it almost, as you and I were talking in the turbo lift, it was almost like, you know, your typical 80s, almost felt like a Reading Rainbow or waiting for, you know, the moral of the story at the end of the thing. I think honestly, Geordi should have been doing that little commentary, maybe as a PowerPoint. What do you think?
Well, Tasha Yar and Wesley almost break down into a, you know, Saturday after or an after school special type commentary on the dangers of drug addictions.
Yeah, I thought David was going to whip out a guitar.
I sort of envisioned Geordi giving a PowerPoint followed by you know, an after school special.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, as I listened to the dialogue as Tasha is talking to Wesley about drug addiction, I was really waiting for Data to say something like, "And now, Wesley, if you'll turn your attention to the view screen, I would like to share with you a video from the late 20th century." And then it's, you know, it's Nancy Reagan's Just Say No video.
I kind of picture Geordi, you know, LeVar Burton standing there saying, you know, like, as if he's on Reading Rainbow, "Don't just take our word for it." And then, you know, cue the inspiring clip.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know that honestly, Zachary, that's probably a little bit of a. This is a cheesy example, but this is what I think Star Trek does very well. And honestly, in television, I don't think we've always done a good job talking about topics like drug addiction. Star Trek did it one other time with T'Pol's Trillium D addiction, and they did it in a way that I thought was very respectful about the plight of drug addiction. And here we see it in the context of not just the effects on the Inarans, but also the way in which the Brekkens exploit the need that the Inarans have for this narcotic, and we'll get into that as we get into the episode. But I really enjoy this episode. It was fun to see Merritt Buttrick playing, you know, this Inaran, seeing him in particular across the, you know, across the table from, you know, here's Kirk's son across the table from Khan's right hand man. It was Star Trek all the way. I love it.
Well, you know, when I watch this episode, I have to put myself back in the late 1980s. You know, this is at the height of the "just say no" Nancy Reagan approach to drugs. And it's, you know, I think, you know, the current issues surrounding drug addiction are things like recreational drugs like marijuana, right? And here we're talking, you know, 1980s, you know, crack cocaine kind of drug. So, you know, when we're talking about narcotics in this episode, you know, they're really channeling, they're really, really harmful drugs. And I think that accounts for some of some of Picard's reaction to dilemma surrounding the addiction of the Ornarans to Felicium. You know, this is a drug that is essentially harming their society. These people look really strung out, right? They're not able to achieve all the sort of natural, ordinary happiness in day-to-day life because they're always worried about getting their next narcotic hit. And so one of the interesting questions I have surrounding the Prime Directive here is, you know, what if the drug had been literally sort of necessary to keep the Ornarans alive? What if it were more harmful? What if it were less harmful? You know, Picard appeals at the end of the episode very, almost too easily to non-interference, to the fact that in general the Prime Directive is a good principle because it minimizes the harm that's caused from interference. In fact, he has a really inspiring quote which I've brought here. In fact, it's a quote over some very inspiring music.
Can you do it in a Picard voice?
I can't, and I have far too much hair. So Picard says, "The Prime Directive is not just a set of rules, it is a philosophy and a very correct one. History has proved again and again that whenever mankind interferes with a less developed civilization, no matter how well-intentioned that interference may be, the results are invariably disastrous." And so, you know, this is an interesting case where, you know, Picard is faced with the dilemma of, you know, trying to, find a way out of this dilemma. You know, if the Brekkens get that shipment to the Arnarans, they're going to propagate this drug addiction and continue this sort of downward spiral of these Arnarans. But it's not a life threatening spiral, and so the way that Felicium actually sort of affects the Arnarans seems to affect the discussion on the Prime Directive, at least in terms of the consequences that are going to follow. If it were a less harmful drug, like a purely recreational drug, would that have changed Picard's reaction? If it were a more harmful drug, if the Arnarans were going to start dying as a result of the drug. And in this case, you know, the stakes are somewhat low, I think, for a Prime Directive episode. I think the stakes are relatively low. Sometimes we're seeing cases of like an asteroid is going to hit a planet and people are going to die, and Picard chooses, you know, not to interfere or to interfere, but the stakes are really, really high. Like the whole planet's population is at stake. But in this episode, it seems like the stakes are really low. If the Arnarans don't get their shipment of Felicium, they're going to suffer a little bit, but they're not going to start dying, and they're essentially going to get over it someday. So what do you think about that, Mike? I mean, the stakes seem a little low. Would Picard's reaction have been different if the stakes were different? In other words, if the consequences of his choice were more dramatic in some way?
Yeah, I think I mentioned this already, but you know, most of the time when we hear the words Prime Directive in a Star Trek episode, that's usually a cue that we're about to throw that rule out the window and we're going to do something to save a race. And honestly, the best example I can think of is Star Trek Into Darkness. You know, when Kirk and McCoy steal a sacred text and basically lure, I think the name of the race was the Nibiru, they lure them away from their encampment, thus saving them from this volcano. Spock's down there trying to set off a cold fusion device, and then he gets stuck, and now Kirk takes the ship, brings it up out of the water, flies it over for all the Nibiru people to see, and he saves Spock just in the nick of time, and he takes off as we see the Nibiru people draw the Enterprise into the dirt and start worshiping it. So there's an example of throwing the Prime Directive out the window and doing what I think Immanuel Kant would have probably said was the right thing to do.
Well, Kirk makes a really good counterpoint in Into Darkness, right? Kirk basically says, look, this civilization was going to die. How have I harmed them by saving them?
Yes.
You know, and that's essentially Crusher's reply to Captain Picard. Crusher says in response to Picard's point, it's hard to be philosophical when faced with suffering. That's a quote from Dr. Crusher. And that's her point. You know, by helping the Arnarans get free of their drug addiction, how exactly are we harming them? If anything, we're making their society a lot better. At least you could argue that maybe freeing the Arnarans of their drug addiction would be returning them to their natural state, which has been somewhat corrupted by the Brekkens' exploitation of their addiction.
Yeah, actually, what I find fascinating in this episode is we're not just dealing with a recreational drug. This was actually it started out to be a medicine, a needed medicine that was needed to wipe out a plague 200 years earlier, and the medicine succeeded in doing that. But the Brekkens figured out that there was an addiction inherent to it, which, you know, like many painkillers today, and there are people, perhaps even some of our listeners, Zachary, who are listening to us out there on iTunes, who may be struggling with a prescription drug addiction. Many of the painkillers that are often prescribed after surgeries and, you know, as a result of broken bones and things of this nature sometimes are very, very addicting, and people become dependent on them. And I think that's what we see here with the Arnarans, and the Brekkens have figured out how to exploit the addiction that they have and in order to obviously better themselves. And that's the contrast that we see here. The Arnarans are, you know, very strung out, and they look sickly, and, you know, their clothes are drab. And then you have the Brekkens, who are, you know, attractive and well-dressed and well-spoken, and So you've got these two societies, and yes, you're right. The stakes do seem kind of low, and I have pondered, you know, what would have been Picard's take on this if the stakes would have been much higher. What if, for instance, Felicium was not only addictive but deadly? Would he have reacted in the same way? I really don't have an answer to that. I think Crusher probably speaks for a lot of Star Trek fans when she says it's hard to be philosophical when faced with suffering. And I mentioned Immanuel Kant earlier. You know, that was kind of his philosophy. You see suffering, you do something about it. And so I think, you know, if it would have been Dr. Immanuel Kant rather than Dr. Beverly Crusher, I think that probably would have been his take as well.
Well, one thing on my mind here as we're talking about the Prime Directive is its applicability. You know, one question that I have is whether the cultures involved, whether the Prime Directive, I guess, really applies at all is what I'm trying to say. The cultures involved they're warp capable. They've essentially asked for assistance, right? The Ornerans mm-hmm. are saying, you know, please help us fix our ships. You know, they're somewhat pack-led like, right? They can't fix their own ship. Please fix our ship so we can get our medicine that we need. And I should say too, just a side note, I love that it's called Felicium because, you know, that essentially means happiness pill, happiness drug, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, it's a narcotic, but it's essentially just a pill that makes them happy. And if they don't get their drug, they look strung out and they're not happy looking anymore, but it's not a harmful drug. And they hand wave a little bit on how exactly a narcotic can cure a plague and then, you know, be addictive. You know, they don't really explain that in the episode, but
it's Star Trek. Right. They get a pass.
So one question is, you know, we've kind of styled this episode to be a Prime Directive episode. And of course, Picard cites the Prime Directive as justification for his ultimate solution, which is not giving them the coils and letting the two worlds sort it out on their own. maybe restoring them to their more natural state. But since the cultures involved are warp capable, it's not like it's a first contact situation. They've asked for assistance. Is the Prime Directive, is Picard correct that the Prime Directive applies here? It's not obvious at first glance that it does.
You know, interestingly, I did a little research on the Prime Directive. And, you know, when we talk about the Prime Directive, we're talking about what oftentimes in the original series was known as Starfleet's General Order 1. It's also called the Non-Interference Directive. Or if you're an Enterprise fan, all of my Enterprise fans out there, all the boomers out there will remember this line. You're talking about that non-interference crap that T'Pol keeps shoving down our throats. That was the Enterprise version of this. So when we talk about the Prime Directive, we're talking, Zachary, about this idea of refraining from interfering in the natural, unassisted development of societies, even if such interference was well-intentioned. Mm-hmm. I don't know necessarily about applying this just to warp-capable cultures. I think the spirit, at least, of the Prime Directive is the idea of really not interfering in the natural, unassisted development of a society, regardless of their warp capability or a first contact situation.
Well, this is a bit of a tangential question, but it's an important one. Doesn't that preclude the possibility of any sort of diplomatic relations? The second you enter diplomatic relations with any other world, regardless mm-hmm. of the intentions, you know, presumably there's good intentions, you know, whether it's worlds that are about to join the Federation and whatnot, isn't that inherently some sort of interference with the natural development? You know, if the Federation weren't around, right, their society would develop in a different way. So that seems like it's almost too broad of a definition. It precludes the possibility of any diplomatic action whatsoever.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. I think about, and there's so many episodes in which, you know, the Prime Directive was basically, you know, thrown out the airlock in the episode. It seems like this particular directive is something that is open for debate. Starship captains debate it. Kirk famously in Omega Glory made the statement that for starship captains, their most solemn oath is that he will give his life, even his entire crew, rather than violate the Prime Directive. But Captain Kirk probably violated the Prime Directive, probably more so than any other Starfleet captain, and he only had 3 seasons to do it.
Well, there's kind of a hypocrisy, or maybe even a better word would be hegemony, you know, this to the Prime Directive. You know, on the one hand, you know, if a world that the Federation interacts with is not on the fast track to joining the Federation, then generally the policy is non-interference, like let them develop according to their own natural devices. But if they're on the fast track to joining the Federation, in other words, if they share the same kinds of values that Starfleet and the Federation do, then it's okay to interfere, right? Then you can start diplomatic relations, you can sort of encourage them to join the Federation, you can talk about treaties and mutual benefit and whatnot, and that seems a lot more like interference. But it seems somewhat hypocritical, right? If you agree with us, you can join the club, and if you don't agree with us, then you can be left to your own devices and progress at your own rate.
Yeah, and later on in the series, we see the Federation, you know, getting heavily involved. I mean, deeply steeped into what is going on with what we came to understand at that time as being the Bajora, the Bajoran people. And we see a lot of interference, a lot of intervention from Captain Picard and the Enterprise D, and the Bajoran plight. Against the oppression of Cardassia. So again, we see the Prime Directive getting set aside. And here's a culture, Zachary. Yes, they're warp capable. Obviously, the Federation is interested in bringing them in. But even once we get to Deep Space Nine, the Bajoran people aren't exactly all putting out the welcome mat for the Federation. So in essence, one could, you know, possibly make the argument that the Federation's interfered in the natural development of the Bajoran people. So, you know, what's different here, I'm not sure, other than the fact that you have the Brekkens. Picard said that the relationship between the Brekkens and the Inarans was a symbiotic relationship. Obviously, Beverly Crusher, right on the bridge, by the way, I noticed that, disagreed with him. And, you know, I'll never forget, he points his finger at him, he says, from your point of view. And that's, I think, what it comes down to when we talk about the Prime Directive, Zachary. We're talking about one's point of view. And even for Captain Picard, that point of view changes from dilemma to dilemma.
How much of this is Captain Picard just developing as a character, right? This is season 1, and season 1 Picard is the Picard who's not a family man and doesn't like children on the ship, and he's much more of a stodgy old rule follower, I think, right? And, you know, in season 1, you do get some, you know, really interesting character moments of development for Picard, where you see behind the mask and you see the real person underneath with feeling, but he really kind of bottles it up real quick, especially projected outward to his crew. So I wonder if just how much of this is in season 1, Picard is more of a rule follower, and in later seasons, as you get a little more character development as Picard loosens up as a character, and maybe as Patrick Stewart loosens up as an actor, the writers were more willing to have Picard be a rule breaker, be, you know, something more along the lines of the original series Captain Kirk, who was willing to break the rules left and right, for the sake of making his own moral judgments. And so certainly, you know, by the time the Bajorans are on the season in the latter part of Star Trek: The Next Generation, when they're introduced, Picard is very willing to interfere, right? Mm-hmm. But that's because the Federation has maybe a vested interest in the Bajorans joining the Federation, and so it's somewhat self-serving there. And so, you know, what I'm searching for is like a way of deciding, you know, when is it okay to interfere, when is it not? Because it's not like the Federation or even Picard very consistently fails to interfere. But in this first season, it's the stodgy old Picard who doesn't want to interfere, doesn't want to break the rules, is happy to, in other words, he's happy to cite the rule as a reason to get him off the hook having to decide what to do in this case. And I guess that's my complaint about his decision at the end of the day, is that he chooses the easy path, which is just to say, we're taking our ball and bat and going home. You can't have your warp coils figured out yourselves, you know. Yay, Prime Directive.
Yeah, it just occurred to me that I think the rules are Captain Picard's Felicium. Right. These are my happiness pills. number one.
You know, that's the thing. It's the easy solution. It's like, and you know, and I guess easy solutions always bother me a little bit, right? It's always easy to take the easy solution, right? It's easy to sit on the couch and not try to improve yourself. It's hard to get out your front door and go find a new career or go to school or whatever. You know, I think Picard takes the path of least resistance here. And to me, it strikes me as if, even though he's really high and mighty, and this is one of the great Picard speeches, right? Picard, you know, the prime he's on his soapbox. The prime directive is not just a set of rules. Okay, I'm channeling Picard.
Cue the music.
It is a philosophy.
Cue the music.
And a very correct one. Cue the music, right? It's a very lofty speech, but at the same time, the subtext is this really gets me off the hook, and I don't have to really solve the problems on these two worlds.
That's what I find so interesting about his decision here, Zachary, because in applying the prime directive, he really, in some ways, breaches the prime directive. Because his solution was very interesting. I'm not going to interfere, and by not interfering, I am interfering.
Well, that's it exactly. And we made this point when we were discussing existentialism and free will, the idea that not acting is still a choice, mm-hmm. right? And it's not like you can't see what the consequences are. I mean, it's one thing if you literally don't know what the consequences are going to be, you don't know how the societies are going to develop, so you want to be more like a scientist and be hands-off, and so you can observe and just let things progress according to their own natural devices, natural progression. But that's not what's going on here. I think you have some really foreseeable consequences,
yeah.
right? You know, if the Renarins get their drug, they're going to continue to be addicted, and that's going to harm them. If you don't give the warp coils over and cease the shipment of this Felicium, then you're going to have economic ruin on the Brecken world. And so those are really easy consequences to predict. And no matter which way Picard goes, someone is going to be harmed in the mm-hmm. process. It's just a question of how much harm to whom. And it's not like he's not making a choice there. He's choosing to harm the Breckens versus harming the Renarins.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Again.
Not with ill will.
No.
It's just a matter of fact that, you know, the Brecken world will be, you know, their whole economy is geared around producing Felicium, right? So, you know, it's just a matter of fact that economy will be tanked. In making that decision. It's not like he's ignoring that.
Yeah. Talk about being stuck between a rock and a hard place. Not only does he have the moral dilemma of, you know, to what degree does he insert the Federation into this relationship between the Breckens and the Renarins, but he's got his chief medical officer there saying to him, you know, listen, I can't just stand by. And she offers a solution. Her solution is, Captain, I can synthesize something that, you know, will help them, aid them in overcoming the symptoms of withdrawal. And mm-hmm. so she offers what I think many people would deem to be a reasonable solution. However, Captain Picard rightly has to weigh the consequences to the Breckens mm-hmm. and their society. And it's easy to hate them. And that's what I find fascinating. When you first start the episode, I mean, you're looking at, again, the Renarins, who are raggedy and disconnected, and you have the Breckens, who are attractive and well-dressed and well-spoken, and you can almost immediately jump to a conclusion that the Breckens are great and the Renarins are idiots, and you can walk away and leave it at that, but then you suddenly begin to switch. And again, this is one of the things I love about this episode is once you know, my grandfather used to say, you know, never judge a man till you walk a mile in his shoes. And how right my grandfather was. And so, you know, once we begin to understand what's going on here, suddenly, you know, the whole thing kind of gets reversed. You begin to feel a sense of pity for the Renarins, and you begin to despise the Breckens. And so Captain Picard, rightly so, is not only in the middle of this situation, having to weigh the consequences for both of these societies, but his chief mm-hmm. medical officer is there saying, hey, we can't just warp out of here and do nothing.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned Kantian ethics.
Yes.
And as you were talking a minute ago, I was trying to think, how do I tell this story in terms of Kantian ethics and, you know, what moral tension arises as a result here? And the discussion between Picard and Crusher is fascinating because they each have their own set of rules, right? Picard has his prime directive that he has to follow, and Crusher has the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, mm-hmm. rule that she has to follow. And that's one of the main criticisms of Kantian ethics or rule-based ethics, that, you know, for Kantian ethics, you're supposed to act out of duty, right? You figure out what the rules are, what the right thing to do is, and then you have a duty to do the right thing, whatever that is. And one of the obvious criticisms is, well, sometimes our duties conflict with each other, right? Picard and Dr. Crusher have different duties in this regard. And in this case, you can't just appeal to the Federation's duty or Starfleet's duty, right? As captain of a starship who has to deal with the prime directive, Picard has his duty. Mm-hmm. And Crusher has her very specific duty regarding the preservation of life and doing no harm and whatnot. And those just seem to conflict with each other in this case. And so philosophically, I ask, well, what do you do in the case of these conflicting values? And that's one of the advantages of other ethical theories like virtue ethics that we talked about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Klingon virtue ethics. You know, if with rules, you the goal is to follow the rule, right? And that's a very dispassionate approach to ethics, right? Once you know what the rule is, you have a duty to do it, and you don't worry about the consequences, and you don't worry about your emotions, and that's the end of the matter for rule-based ethics.
Right.
But if pity is a relevant factor, I think Dr. Crusher pities these people, right? She sees that they're suffering. She if it's not pity, it's sympathy or something along those lines, right? Sympathy or empathy or pity. I'm not sure exactly which here. Maybe all the above in some way. And you know, is that a relevant factor or not? Is the fact that she's emotionally stirred by the suffering of these people that she knows she can prevent in her role as chief medical officer, is that morally relevant or not? And on virtue ethics, where the goal is to, you know, cultivate certain virtues. And one of the virtues, I think, as people, if not as a physician, is to have, you know, healthy relationships with people, to form emotional bonds, and approaching other people in that more relational way versus a more rule-based way, gives some credence to Crusher's reply, which is that, look, I can't be philosophical. I can't just follow the rules when I'm faced with suffering. That's not being a virtuous doctor. That's not what it means to be a doctor.
Right. Yeah. And I think she finds herself, albeit the stakes are much lower here in this episode, I think she finds herself in the same moral dilemma as Dr. Bashir finds himself in season 4 episode of Deep Space Nine, Hippocratic Oath, in which he finds himself in the midst of Jemadar, one of which who has managed to beat the Ketracel White addiction. And so, you know, Bashir is lassoed into trying to come up with a means to replicate that effect for the rest of the Jemadar. And he is committed to this because his personal ethics dictate that that's what he should do. A Hippocratic Oath, obviously, being the title of the episode. But we also have, on the other side of that argument, we have Chief O'Brien, who's a soldier. He is your quintessential soldier. And this is the enemy that we're dealing with. And we don't do anything, you know, to help the enemy. So again, the stakes are much higher here because we are at war with the Dominion. But I think the situations are very similar in that we see an addicted race, and what is a doctor to do when faced with that kind of suffering? And I think Crusher comes from the same place here in this episode.
I just made a connection in my mind to the movie Insurrection, the Next Generation movie Insurrection, when Picard mm-hmm. says it's too easy to turn a blind eye to the suffering of a people you don't know. And it's interesting that, you know, in that case, you know, if you know people, if you have a relationship with them, it's much harder to just to ignore the suffering when you know you can do something about it. And I think it's almost too convenient to take these two different perspectives and put them in the perspective of two different characters. You know, like Picard has to deal with the prime directive issues, and Crusher has to deal with the medical issues, and those virtues don't add up, but they're in two different characters, and it creates some interesting tension, dramatic tension between Crusher and Picard. But, you know, Picard didn't take any time to get to know the Ornarans either. It would be interesting to see, you know, what right. if he had, what if there was already a better relationship with this planet? What if he'd known more of the people? What if he'd spent an hour having coffee with them, right? Or a cup of Earl Grey.
Cup of Earl Grey.
You know, he didn't even do that much, right? And so it's very easy at the end of the episode to be abstract and cite the Prime Directive in some sort of lofty sense. But if he'd taken an hour to get to know the Ornarans, would he have had the same reaction? And would he have been right to have the same reaction, even if he had spent that time?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what he would have done if, for instance, he would have been in a shuttle accident and had been, stranded among them for a day or two, and saw the suffering on a planetary scale as opposed to, you know, just a handful of seemingly refugees, you know, that he saved from a disaster.
And I think that, you know, that's one of the faults of Star Trek: The Next Generation in general is sometimes in these episodes they tried to do too much, right? I mean, think of the things you get in this episode. You get the Prime Directive issue, you get the drug addiction commentary, you even get some interesting sci-fi stuff with the solar flare and these aliens that have this electric charge because of the solar flare, as if they're, you know, some sort of electric Superman or something.
And yeah,
the yellow
cool
sun causes them to have some sort of electric charge, you know, and I think the Next Generation had this identity crisis, right? Is it a science fiction show or is it a drama show? Is it social commentary? What is it? It's all the above. I can imagine sitting in the writing room and someone saying, oh, okay, what kind of story do we want to tell this week? Let's do a Prime Directive story. Okay, what's the issue going to be? Okay, drug addiction. Oh, great. It's the 1980s. You know, drug addiction's a relevant issue. Let's do something on drug addiction. Oh, wait, but it's still science fiction. We have to get some interesting sci-fi concept in there. And, you know, all of those things distract from the character moments that could have been, right? If Picard had, you know, I would be just as happy to see half an hour of a show like this where Picard is getting to know these people, the Ornarans, and starting to feel their pain. And Crusher is much closer to that than Picard is, I think. She's more sympathetic, I think. Picard is trying to remain neutral and trying to remain dispassionate in his role as captain, especially in these early seasons. But I would love to see an early episode where Picard is stuck in a shuttlecraft, kind of like that episode where he's stuck in a shuttlecraft with Wesley, having to have the conversation, mm-hmm. right, that he doesn't want to have, but he starts to open up and reveal a bit more of himself. If we had seen that, that would have been a much more dramatic episode from the perspective of an internal drama in Captain Picard's mind, right? If he's literally starting to sympathize with their suffering, he knows them more. I think he might have reached a very different conclusion at the end of the episode.
Yeah. A kind of a humorous side note. I think Jonathan Frakes should get some kind of award. I can't imagine how many takes. How long did he have to stand there with that look on his face?
Did you ever hear William Shatner comment on what it's like to film a science fiction show or movie?
No, huh?
There's an interview with him. I wish I remember when it happened. He said, basically, they paint a big X on the wall and they say, okay, now look at the X. There's where the monster is going to be. Now look afraid. We don't know what it's going to look like yet, but we'll figure that out in post-production. You know, something to that effect. So, you know, this guy's clutching his chest and he's got to look like he's paralyzed and afraid. And, you know, there's no electric effects yet. That's all done in post-production. So,
and it's the same daggone look, and you know, only God knows how many takes and the same crazy look on his face. Of course, the stuff they lassoed John Frakes into doing, rolling around in Karo's syrup and printer's ink,
doing kung fu kicks, yeah,
okay, indeed. I digress. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of think about, Picard's whole approach to this situation, and trying to see this from obviously a different perspective. And he has an obligation to his crew as well, because as captain, he's got to set that standard, that example. He's the one who has to apply the rules, even when, and I think the relationship that he has with Beverly Crusher at this point is, you know, fairly well defined. We know that there's, you know, a romantic attraction as well there, I think, between the two of them. And so, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because he has a duty to her as a superior officer, but also as somebody who truly at his core cares about her and cares about what she thinks. You know, I think he's kind of stuck there. And then on the other side, you have, you know, what do I do here in this situation? He really is between a rock and a hard place. And that's one of the reasons why I find his solution really so fascinating because he really comes up with a way to interfere without interfering, and he applies, I think, the prime directive correctly. Even though my own personal ethics would say, I'd lean more towards Beverly Crusher. There's something we've got to be able to do here to help these Inarans overcome this addiction.
Yeah, I think happily in this case, sticking to the letter of the prime directive leads to an outcome that is acceptable for Picard, right? He's going to, he's thinking long term, right? In the long term, the Inarans are going to get over their drug addiction. And in the short to medium term, he gets to stick it to the Brekkens, who no one on the ship likes. Picard doesn't like them. Crusher doesn't like them. And, I think he knows that they're going to have to reinvent their world, right? But Picard, I don't think he's blind to the fact that there's an exploitative relationship going on here, right? The Brekkens are essentially exploiting the Inarians. They know it. It's not like they're ignorant of it. They discover that in the course of the episode. And Picard is, I think he might be looking for a way to stick it to them. But, are you saying, I guess I'm trying to say, are we formulating the hypothesis that Picard is... When he cites the prime directive in his very inspiring speech over the music, is that disingenuous in some way? Does he know that he's sticking it to the Brekkens and the prime directive is an excuse, or does he really believe the shtick he gives about the prime directive?
Honestly, I think he believes the shtick, especially at this particular point of his character development. You raised that point earlier, and I think it's an excellent point to make. I think at this point in his character development, he really does believe the shtick. I really, as a fan, as a viewer, I'm watching this episode, and I really believe that he is, even though the stakes are relatively low, I do believe that he is between a rock and a hard place, and he truly is trying to come up with a way pull himself and his crew out of this situation without coming across as being uncaring and just unconcerned about the whole thing.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about here is basically the title of the episode, Symbiosis, right? That implies some sort of biological symbiotic relationship, right? You think of symbiosis in the natural world, that there's a beauty to symbiosis, right? Maybe an aesthetic beauty, creatures that depend on each other in some way. It's not like a parasite, right? Where a parasite is destroying its host in the process and destroying itself in the process. A symbiotic relationship implies some sort of mutually beneficial stasis. And, is the title of this episode itself somewhat ironic? Is this not supposed to be a true symbiotic relationship? Is this more like exploitation? Or from the perspective of the prime directive, regardless of our moral judgments about whether exploitation is a good thing or a bad thing, is the relationship between these two worlds something that developed naturally in their own progression that is akin to a biological symbiotic relationship that we shouldn't interfere with and that we maybe even respect for its own naturalness or its own nature? Or is it something more like exploitation where we can look at it and say, no, this is just bad. This situation didn't arise in the natural course of these worlds. This is one world imposing itself on another and exploiting the other. What do you think? Are you team symbiotic relationship or are you team exploitation here, Mike?
Me personally, I'm team exploitation without a doubt, because, you made the point, and I think you're correct. I mean, the Brekkens even understand that they're exploiting these folks. And maybe it was written that way, and maybe it's something that we just, we get from the actors themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Is it Jetson Scott and Kimberly Farr? Are they just behaving suspiciously, or is that truly written in that they understand the nature of the relationship between the Brekkens and the Inarans? Do they truly grasp the fact that they basically created a slave race, Zachary? And that's how I view it. It wasn't a symbiosis. They have exploited these Inarans to the point that they have become a slave race. Their sole purpose is to bring their stuff to the Brekkens in exchange for drugs. They've become a slave to the Brekkens in exchange for their narcotic, their happiness pill, their Felicium. So I
Well, I think invoking the happiness pill, this Felicium, is a really fascinating writing concept here. I think, because on the one hand, you know, it looks like a terrible relationship, right? It looks like it's exploitation. You've got the Breckens who are profiting. You've got
the drug dealers.
Or Narons who are suffering, or at least will be suffering if they don't get their Felicium, right?
The drug dealers and the addicts.
But, you know, you can ask this question, well, what's so wrong with a happiness pill, right? If it's possible to take a pill and be as high as a kite and happy as can be, it's like Barclay living in the holodeck, right? I mean, there's an addictive component to being in the holodeck. The holodeck can make you happy. It ignores reality to some degree. But there's no suffering. There's no displeasure. It's generally a fairly happy state of affairs. You know, if the entire planet is high on this pill, you know, we still look at it and we say, wait, there's something missing out of that kind of life, right? If you're just high on happiness pills or on Felicium the whole time, you're missing some important aspects of life. I think Picard would make that point, that life isn't all about happiness, right? Like, or Captain Kirk would say, I need my pain, right? That's an important part of human experience. But you can ask the question, well, if the goal is to minimize suffering, what's so wrong with a happiness pill, right? You've got the Breckens who are profiting. They're living a life of luxury. You've got the Onarans who are, you know, doped up and happy all the time. So why exactly is that a bad situation? I mean, I think that's the genius of calling it Felicium, right? This isn't just a drug that's tearing them apart. This is a pill that makes them happy.
Well, and that during the after-school special portion of this particular Star Trek The Next Generation episode, we get a history lesson. We know this has gone on for 200 years. We also get, you know, the great commentary, Tasha Yar's drug commentary, that was so read off a cue card. Not one of Denise Crosby's finest moments in acting, but I, the campiness, I kind of like it. And I like the fact that they addressed this. And I think they did it in a way that, you know, for me at that point in time, I was in my upper teens and, you know, perhaps that would have been something I would have responded to, you know, at that point in time. It was honest. I felt like there was an honesty to it because she said, you know, the drugs, yeah, they make you feel great. They make you feel on top of the world, but it's, you know, it's synthetic. It's not natural. And, you know, so she raises the point that, yeah, you know, this is a happiness pill and, you know, it does fill you with confidence, but, you know, there's another side to this and it is something that's dark and it is something that can damage. And I think, Zachary, we see the damage that this happiness pill has caused. We've got an entire planet, an entire race of people that have no motivation, no drive. They can't fix their own ships. And even Picard, you know, comments, you know, as you know, only Patrick Stewart can pull the, you know, throws in a couple expletives in there, and you know, how in the hell do they go out in ships and they don't even know the basic functions of them? Number one, you know. And he makes a good point. And as somebody who has worked with people of varying addictions, not just drug or alcohol addictions, but you know, we talk about different addictions out there. There are people who are addicted to pornography. They have addictions to television. Honestly, it's kind of interesting the things that people will throw their whole lives away over. And that's one of the things that we see sort of at the end of addiction is people start to trade at least what you or I would consider to be a normal, productive, functioning existence for whatever it is that they're addicted to. And they begin to disconnect themselves from society. You mentioned Barclay. I mean, we recognize his holodeck addiction as an addiction because he has disconnected himself from meaningful relationships. And in fact, that's one of the commentaries about the holodeck that we find in the Star Trek universe, that too much time in a holodeck, one becomes as hollow as the characters in which they're interacting with in the holodeck itself. So, you know, we recognize it's an addiction because in the end, even though while Barclay's in the holodeck or while the Onarans are taking the Felicium or, you know, insert whatever you like there. You do feel on top of the world. You do have confidence. Barkley was confident, and everybody else was a joke, but Barkley had confidence. But in the end, there was damage done, and he was less, if you will, effective as a person in true interpersonal relationships.
I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the fact that Barkley, when he says he's lost himself in Voyager, is the most meta commentary there is on Star Trek fandom. Any one of us could be addicted to Star Trek, right? But yeah, you mentioned something when you were talking about Tasha Yar's speech that Tasha Yar tells Wesley that the high you get from a drug addiction, but Felicium in this case, is an artificial pleasure, right? It's not a naturally developed pleasure. And I think the fact that this situation in the episode Symbiosis involves two worlds, that makes it seem even more artificial, right? It's not as if Felicium was something that's cultivated on the Ornarin's own world and they developed a symbiotic relationship with its production in their own society, right? This is another society from outside imposing Felicium on them, giving them this artificial high. So given all of that, it seems that itself doesn't strike me as a natural part of their development in a very strict sense. Although from the perspective of Picard, right, he does have this kind of symbiotic relationship between these two worlds, right? It doesn't make sense, I think, to talk of the Felicium addiction as symbiotic with the Ornarins on their own world. But from Picard's standpoint, these two worlds have evolved, maybe through some questionable moral choices from his point of view, but they've evolved together, and now they're in a relatively stable situation. It's, you know, it's not like the Ornarins are dying, and it's not like the Brekkens are about to, you know, cease production of Felicium on their planet. So it's a very stable situation. So it's symbiotic in that sense. But it might be the fact that it's an artificial, that the Felicium addiction is an artificial pleasure that's introduced to the Ornarians from outside, from the Brekkens, that's the deciding factor in terms of whether it's a genuinely symbiotic relationship in some sort of naturalistic sense, or whether it's more like moral exploration.
Yeah, the other side of that coin, and it is easy, I think, for one to insert their own ideas and philosophies into this and draw conclusions. And that's the interesting thing that Picard does here when talking to Beverly Crusher. He says, listen, that's what's going on from your perspective, from your point of view. And so it's easy to insert one's point of view and draw all kinds of conclusions. But Picard recognizes that this could be a symbiotic relationship between these two cultures. And as much as I can sit here and say, well, you know, the Brekkens knew that they were exploiting them, and they know that obviously the effects of the drug, and they know that these Ornarins are bringing everything that they've got to them. Let's look at it from the other perspective. One could say, well, you know, the Brekkens were blackmailing, if you will, if I can use that term, blackmailing the Ornarins into surrendering whatever it is that they offered up for payment. I don't think they ever really got into that. We just know they pretty much surrender everything they've got to the Brekkens. That's the understanding.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Yeah, they never really get into that. We just know that everything they got, they surrender. And so whatever it is that they brought to the Brekkens, let's look at this from the other point of view. The Brekkens are just as addicted to the support that they're receiving from the Ornarins. I mean, everything that the Ornarins do as a society, they do to the benefit of the Brekkens. So a ceasing of production of Felicium would have just a catastrophic effect on the Ornarins, not bringing all their stuff to the Brekkens to serve them, I think would have equally catastrophic effects. And so, you know, you have to take that again. From my point of view, the Brekkens become scumbags at the end of this episode, and I feel really bad for the Ornarins. But I have to be able to, if I'm any good at analyzing this from a philosophical point of view, I really have to stop and ask some questions and try to look at this from the other point of view. And that point of view being, you know, what is the effect on the Brekkens society if Captain Picard does something directly to interfere here?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. You know, we've been focusing on one direction of the economic exchange, right? The Felicium going from the Breccans to the Ornarans. But there's another side of the economic exchange, right? The Ornarans are giving their stuff, their, you know, whatever it is, right? They don't really say, but, you know, like you said, their entire society is built around, you know, giving the Breccans whatever they need to keep producing the Felicium so they can get their drug addiction. But there's this transfer of material, you could call it wealth maybe, from the Ornaran world to the Breccan world. And in my notes here for today, I have the fact that this episode could be conceived as a thinly veiled commentary or criticism of, you know, this materialistic, capitalistic world that, frankly, we live in today, right? And definitely lived in the 80s, even more so than today. I think the material culture was mm-hmm. run rampant in the 1980s, even more so than now, I would say. So is this episode intended to be sort of an expression of Star Trek's or Gene Roddenberry's post-capitalist ideals? Is this criticism of people who profit at the expense of others and criticism of this this need for material wealth? I think that maybe gets lost mm-hmm. a little bit in the episode. We're focusing so much on the drug addiction aspect, but we're forgetting that the Breccan's dislikability, for lack of a better word, is tied up with the fact that they're profiting from other people's at other people's expense, right? They're building this material culture. I mean, even their clothes mm-hmm. are beautiful and sparkly and shiny in a very 1980s kind of way, right? They have that sparkly metal material that they made the Next Generation pillows. Yeah, it looks out like of, looks, right?
You remember parachute pants, Zachary?
Yes, they're metallic parachute pants. That's exactly
Throw
right.
Throw on some Aquanet and it's totally 80s.
Exactly. So, but is this, are we reading this into the episode, or was that an explicit goal of this episode was to criticize capitalist ideals in favor of a non-economic sort of post-capitalist ideal that Star Trek is sometimes
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For me, at least, the easy answer to that is certainly, I think, yes. You know, however, we have to consider here, you know, and I don't think we can really ask the writer. Perhaps maybe someday we'd have an opportunity to, you know, sit down and talk to some writers of these episodes and get their take, what they were thinking at the time. But certainly, you know, looking at it from my perspective now, I think yes, to some degree, it is a criticism towards those who profit at the expense of others. It certainly, I think, is a criticism, you know, obviously the Just Say No to Drugs campaign of the 1980s, you know, the Reagan administration, that was really a big pet project in the 80s because, you know, we were coming out of the 1960s and 1970s in which, you know, drug use was very rampant among younger people. And now, you know, that generation is aging and many of them are still kind of in a drug culture. And we now have the Generation X generation. And so, you know, there was a campaign. I remember, you know, MTV commercials in which they, you know, they had Aerosmith and you name it. They had, you know, groups doing these commercials on MTV, you know, Just Say No to Drugs in support of that campaign. And, you know, I can remember I was in high school at the time, you know, I was involved in my local Students Against Drunk Driving. And, you know, I was an advocate for, you know, for being drug free. And so, you know, I remember those days actually quite well. And there was a demonization to some degree as a society, Zachary, I think, a demonization of the drug industry. That's when the drug dealer stopped being somewhat enterprising and became very demonized. So I think to some degree it is a criticism. As far as the second part of that question, is an expression of post-capitalist ideas. I don't necessarily see that in this episode. I do think it was a criticism of exploitation and those who profit at the expense of others, but I don't necessarily see an expression of post-capitalist ideas here.
Well, I guess the reason I ask is that it seems to me that in any economic exchange, any practical real-world economic exchange, there's some sort of inequality, right? When retail stores sell you a product, right, they're, you know, the companies are profiting. They're selling you a product for more money than it took them to produce it mm-hmm. or to buy it in the case of retail, right? And there's an inequality there, right? And you could interpret that as people being taken advantage of, right? You know, the consumer who doesn't know any better is in some sense being taken advantage of. Is that an analogy in general for the kind of exploitation you see in this episode? You know, certainly there's an economic exchange, but it's not pure exploitation, right? There's an exchange going on, right? The Breckens are giving the Felicium, and the Renarins are giving some materials back, you know, some sort of payment, right? You could call it, it may not be money, it may be material goods, but it has some economic monetary some mm-hmm. currency value to it, right? Is the economic exchange aspect part of what makes that, and you know, again, in universe now, in terms of Star Trek ideals, is that part of what makes this exploitative and wrong, or is that a healthy part of any economic exchange? I could see it going both ways, and I don't know what the writers originally intended, or even what Gene Roddenberry would say about this. But I could see it going either way. You know, on the one hand, the effects here are particularly bad. It's not just an economic exchange with a little bit of inequality; it's an entire world becoming drug addicts, and this other world living in mm-hmm. material luxury. Right? They've drawn a really stark contrast. But is it the degree of the suffering, or the degree of the situation, the degree of the inequality that accounts for the wrongness of this, or is any sort of economic inequality inherently wrong in favor of something more egalitarian, more communalist, more I'm thinking of some sort of pure economic exchange where, you know, you do your part and I do my part, and almost communist exchange, right? Where you've got your labor and I've got mine, you've got your specialty and I've got mine, and they're all inherently equal. There's no inequality, and everyone kind of gets what they need in some sort of a pure economic exchange without the inequality. Is that sort of the ideal that they're going for here? Or am I drawing an analogy that just doesn't exist in this episode? I could be reading way too much.
I think it's an interesting perspective. All I can say is, if this is an expression of post-capitalist ideas, then I just want to say to Paramount and CBS in particular, pay attention, because, you know, frankly, you talk about exploitation, you know, $48 for one season of TNG Blu-rays when I can watch the darn thing on Netflix for $8 a month. You know, come on, you talk about exploitation. I've got to...
Yeah, the Prime Directive would forbid that. Just, I'm putting it out there.
You know, we talk about the darker side of fandom, you know.
It's not natural.
Somebody takes their food budget for the week to go out and buy a season of TNG on Blu-ray. Not for the episodes, because again, we can see those on Netflix. It's for the stinking extras. You know, a couple of interviews and some, you know, some catchy menus. talk about exploitation.
Well, Mike, we've really squeezed a lot out of this episode in terms of the Prime Directive. There are a couple of other little points I had written down that we could talk about real quickly before we have our final thoughts. One thing that struck out at me this episode is LaForge's choice of course heading at the very end of the episode. You know, I forget the actual course he set, but when Riker asked him, why that direction, why that course, LaForge says, curiosity. We've never been there. And I love that, this is just another feature of this episode that makes this a classic Next Generation Star Trek episode for me. Not only do they have the Prime Directive, not only do they have the social commentary with the drug addiction issue, not only do they have some sci-fi stuff with these aliens and the electric effect because of the sun, but we've got this great Star Trek ending where it's like, we're going off into the final frontier. Let's go somewhere we've never been and ride off into the stars.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, these are the things I think that make this such a fun first season episode, because we do kind of get into, if you will, the nuts and bolts of the Prime Directive. It's got, by the way, I happen to love the electric, the bio-taser idea. That's great. And both these cultures have that ability, and I thought that was a lot of fun. It kind of gives you a kind of a low budget sci-fi thing going on there for them to, you know, to envision that they have this kind of bioelectrical ability, kind of like eels, if you will. You've got your anti-drug after school special there in the middle. And yeah, at the end of the episode, Geordi's going off into the sunset. There's a lot of great wordplay in here, as we already mentioned, Felicium. I'm always interested in a writer's inspiration. And, you know, for them to take
that. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Felicium, because the word Felicium got me thinking. I mean, it's a literary episode, right? Felicium, happiness pill, right? It's a little inside joke. If you knew that means happiness, it's even funnier, right? It means happiness pill. So it got me thinking, well, what about the other terms you get in this episode? And so I looked some of these up. It got me thinking, when I was in college, I took Latin for a few years, and Ornarians, I forget how it's pronounced in the episode, but it struck me, that kind of sounds like a Latin word. Let's see if I can remind myself what that root is. And so I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn. Okay, that's interesting. That doesn't seem really relevant to adorn, like to, you know, to decorate your Christmas tree, to adorn your Christmas tree, or adorn yourself with ornaments, right? It got me thinking, well, what do the Breccans mean then? What's the name of their race mean? So I looked up Brekka, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
That's fascinating.
And I have no interpretation of this. It doesn't, you know, it just seems like an interesting interesting quirk that these terms mean something in Latin and something in Old Norse. Ornare means to adorn, and Brekka means slope or hillside in Old Norse. But can you read any meaning into that at all, Mike? Or is it just, just pure wordplay? Felicium obviously has meaning, right? That means happiness pill. And the writer is using that intentionally as a plot device. But what about the terms ornare or Brekka? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I suppose if you look at these words just based on their meanings alone, we talk about Brekka being Old Norse for slope. I mean, one could say that a relationship with the Breccans would be a slippery slope.
Yeah, I thought about that, like, you know, a downward spiral into into drug addiction.
Hell itself.
And that's interesting, actually. I mean, maybe we're onto something here. Ornare means to adorn.
To adorn with the Felicium.
Well, no, I think it's the other way around. I think actually what's happening is that the Ornarians are adorning the Breccans, right? The Breccans have these fancy clothes. They've got the material wealth, whereas the Breccans are causing the Ornarians to go down a slippery slope into drug addiction. So that's actually a really interesting interpretation. And now I'm wondering if maybe we're the first people to have thought of it.
Yes. So if any of the Star Trek writers are listening to this,
we got the joke.
We got the joke.
That could be, because, you know, it's kind of a stretch of an interpretation. But if you think of adorn in the sense of, you know, make beautiful or make, to make ornamental, then that's exactly what the Ornarians are doing to the Breccans, right? The Breccans have their fancy metallic parachute pants.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on Metatrex. Trek FM.
Better living through etymology.
Indeed.
Well, Mike, do you want to wrap it up with your final thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I really don't have a great deal more to say about this episode than I already have. I think it's an interesting look into what I believe to be a correct application of the Prime Directive. I think Captain Picard was correct to invoke the Prime Directive in this situation. The fact that his non-interference really was, in essence, interference, I thought that was an interesting perspective, to look at it, from there. This wasn't necessarily as obvious an episode when dealing with the Prime Directive as, say, the communicator from, the series Enterprise, where Tech got left behind, and, you know, my goodness, how would this affect that society? So we got to go back and get it. And, you know, oh, by the way, we got captured. Now they know, you know, what we look like on the inside. It wasn't that obvious. One of the things that I love about this episode, and there are many things that I really like about it, and I hope that our listeners don't interpret my saying it's campy or anything like that as negative, because again, one of the things that I love about TNG in particular is its nostalgic effect. When I watch it, there's a campiness to it, and I think it's a great thing. I get the same effect when I watch the original series, which I'm a huge fan of the original series. That was my Trek growing up, but it's not meant to be negative at all. You know, one of the things that I really appreciate about this episode is, that it's not a pew-pew episode. Nobody raised shields or fired phasers we had the bio taser thing going on. But, in the end, we got through an episode and we thought our way through the situation, Zachary. We didn't have to fire a phaser to come up with a solution in the end. Captain Picard effectively thought his way through it. And, you know, we got to examine the Prime Directive in a correct application, But we also got to consider other possibilities as well. In the Next Generation episode, Justice, you know, Picard says, you know, there can be no justice so long as laws are absolute. Even life itself is an exercise in exceptions. So, again, we saw the Prime Directive applied here, but then again, we get to see that even the Prime Directive itself, when correctly applied, is not necessarily an absolute. And certainly there was an exercise here, I think, in exceptions. And they made an exception by involving themselves without getting involved, so that in the end, I think they satisfied every plausible part of this situation without really doing anything at all. And that's one of the things that I appreciate the most about this episode.
Well, I think I'm with you that for me, this episode is very much a 1980s time capsule, especially having grown up, as a kid, right in the middle of the 1980s, just say no drug culture, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this episode speaks to that directly. And so for me, there is this nostalgic factor with this episode. But insofar as this is a Prime Directive episode, to me, it just raises some of the key questions of the Prime Directive, and it deals with it in a very subtle way, I think. One issue is the justification for the Prime Directive, right? Why? Yes, certainly the Federation and Starfleet have this Prime Directive, this non-interference policy, but what is the reason for it? Is the reason because the natural development of a society is intrinsically valuable? Is the reason that it tends to minimize harm? Picard kind of gives a consequentialist justification for the Prime Directive. Whenever we interfere with a less developed civilization, no matter how well-intentioned, the results are disastrous, right? So we have the Prime Directive to avoid harm, and that seems to be Picard's justification for it. And then, of course, there's the issue of its practical applicability, right? What kinds of situations is the Prime Directive invoked in? And I'm not convinced here that this is a genuine Prime Directive situation, insofar as we've tried to make the case that the artificiality of felicium as a drug that's imposed on the Ornerians by the Breckens from outside, right, was something that's not necessarily a natural development. That sounds more like an artificial development. So this seems to deal with the applicability of the Prime Directive, and it's not obvious to me this is really a Prime Directive situation. But it deals with both of those issues, the justification for the Prime Directive and its applicability. You have to deal with whether this is a genuine symbiotic relationship or whether this is more like moral exploitation. You get some fascinating character interaction between Picard and Dr. Crusher taking these different positions and sparring with each other a little bit. That's always nice to see whenever someone stands up to the captain. That's always great. So generally, I think this is a great episode. I'm not sure I have any really deep conclusions to draw from it. It's I think one of the canonical Prime Directive episodes. Definitely must see if you want to dive into the Prime Directive. I'm looking forward to having a similar discussion with different Prime Directive episodes and see if where our intuitions are pulled in different directions than we're pulled in this direction. I think the solution Picard reaches is probably the best solution, right? He's going to let each world figure it out on their own by separating the two, and basically like a parent putting the two children in different corners, right? The Ornarians get to go to their corner and the Breckens go to their corner, and each has to figure it out on their own. And that sounds like a very Prime Directive solution, but I think it's a little disingenuous to couch that in terms of non-interference, right? That's more like actively interfering. A parent separating their children to different corners is as active of a type of interference as you get, I think. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a little more what's going on in this episode. So I don't buy Picard's cue the music speech on the Prime Directive here. It's while it's they're good words and they're spoken very well, I don't think Picard really has that in mind when he's reaching his decision. However much he might actually believe the words, I think he's using them as an excuse to reach a solution that he finds acceptable in this particular example. So this is a great episode. It's a fun one. It's not the deepest episode in a lot of ways because the issues are fairly confined, but it is this 1980s time capsule. Right. It has five or six different attributes that I really enjoy. The science fiction element is interesting because of the electric charge that these aliens have. You get the Prime Directive, you get the drug addiction stuff, you get riding off into the sunset at the end of the day. So this is a very 1980s nostalgia episode for me, and some interesting material about the Prime Directive. So those are my final thoughts.
So we're kind of on differing views as to whether or not the Prime Directive is rightly applied here. So maybe we should throw this out to our listeners. listen, jump on the Babel conference and share your thoughts. Did Captain Picard rightly apply the prime directive here? Was this a prime directive situation? How would you, maybe our listeners would have handled it differently? I'd be interested to get some feedback from our listeners on this particular episode. Again, want to encourage you to go watch it for yourself and get in on the conversation and share your thoughts as well in the Babel conference.
Absolutely. And that's just an open invitation for in general for any episode of MetaTrex. If there's any points you find particularly interesting or some point you disagree with or some other way of interpreting what we're talking about, you know, by no means do we ever intend to be the final word on the issue. You know, we obviously have our own perspectives and things we find interesting and want to talk about. And, you know, we're only two people out of the great many people in the Trek FM family. So if you have any thoughts at all, don't be shy. Don't be a stranger. We all like and respect and trust each other in the Babel conference. So come on and join the discussion and post your thoughts. Don't be a stranger.
Absolutely. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the Prime Directive in Symbiosis today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Sure, it's got the cheesy alien and the cheesy fight scenes, but that's Star Trek. I'm sorry. That's the original series.
Oh, yeah.
And, no, I'm not going to apologize for it. That's Star Trek.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
To the journey! It's very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know what? See, the thing is now, if Star Trek Beyond goes sideways in any way, you've planted that line in my brain. I'm like, I only got half a peg. And I'm just going to trot that out if I don't like Star Trek Beyond.
The 602 Club.
Or staying and trying to turn this guy and almost become the mentor, and he becomes more of the student because he's insane and trying to bring sanity back to him because there's such few Jedi.
Well, and I think that's what Luke was going to do until Mara showed up and needed his help, and she went with him.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episodes that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics, and... We ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature. So, I mean, yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Trex.
You're not going to see a bunch of Klingons hanging around eating cake and you know, laughing at...
Well, unless it's a peptide cake with mint frosting.
Peptide cake, indeed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these and other shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or send us your thoughts on anything that we've discussed on this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us several different ways.
You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also look in the sidebar of our show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us a voicemail.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @TrekFM.
We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. And check us out on the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook or go to the website at TrekFM and click discussion on the menu bar. This is our listeners-only discussion group. It's a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in. And you can join in on all the wonderful discussions we're having about your favorite topics in the Star Trek universe. We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. Get in on that contest we're having. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show.
Well, Mike, when you're not shuttling Felicium around, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
Well, Zachary, I'm on the Babel Conference, of course. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701. How about you, Zachary? Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, likewise, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference. And you can also find me on Twitter under the handle Zachary Fruhling. That's just my name, ZachariFruhling.
We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, executive producers Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director Aaron Harvey, content manager Will Wynn, production manager Richard Marquez, and our fabulous editor and producer Dennis Costello. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
You say Felicium, I say Felicium, you say Ornarins, I say Ornarins, Felicium, Felicium, Ornarins, Ornarins, let's call the whole thing off.
Duh. Doo-doo.
Yeah. Doo-doo.